Remember that day when she looked amazing? Do you remember that day when he just absolutely looked dreamy? Oh! And the hearts were aflutter. And you were out in the break room and flirting with each other and giving that glance and laughing. And finally the day came after that day when he asked you out. Oh, just amazing. And you guys, when you remember, you got the courage up and said, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna ask her out. It's gonna be amazing. And you ask advice from everybody. And you finally make the move. Of course, what's interesting about this whole deal of courting and asking out the girl, or of course, nowadays, the girl asking out the guy, is that as that connection begins, as the couple is then formed, and as the dates get better and better and better, the time becomes sweeter and sweeter, and you begin to think, is this the one? Is she like no other? And she's thinking, oh, he's going to protect me. He's my man. And you are just thrilled. Both of you are just thrilled. And for many of you who are married, watching this video on the family and addiction, are saying, I remember when. But then it happens. It happens where she says, yes. Yes, I'll marry you. Yes, I'll be with you. And he says, oh, honey, wonderful. And you step, you cross the line of commitment. And you're still in that dating stage. You're still kind of in the pre-marriage stage. And you don't know a whole lot about each other. You think you do. Oh, yeah, I know her now. And she's saying, oh, I know all about his family and what they think and so on and so forth. Or do you? Do you? At that stage? Some of you may be thinking to yourselves and yelling at your screen right now, yeah, I did. You better believe it. And others of you are lamenting right now and saying, no, I really didn't. And then the wedding day arrives. Well, here's Cousin Herbert. Here's Cousin Matilda. Oh, yeah, and Uncle Jack over there. Yeah, you don't want to go around him. He's really bad when he's on the sauce. Well, you know about Aunt Gertrude. And she used to be the lady of the night. And you're thinking, what am I marrying into? And things and layers become uncovered sooner or later. Families. Addiction. And here's the other kicker. As the husband, as the wife, on that stage, that wedding day, she says, I do. He says, I do. In front of the minister. I just married off my 22-year-old, by the way, and they said, I do, to each other. It was a beautiful moment. However, what one must realize is that when you say, I do, all of your latent, all of your family of origin expectations of what a husband ought to be, of what a wife ought to be, coming from each person's direction, finally come to the surface. Now, nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with expectations, that they are expected. We need them. So we have structure. We have goals. We have a future and a hope, as Jeremiah 31 says. Or 29:31, excuse me. We have a future and a hope. And so this whole thing of expectations is a healthy thing, but that's why there's premarital counseling. That's why, and now many couples don't take advantage of it. Or if you do get married and didn't have time for it, get it, as far as the marital counseling. Why? Because you need an opportunity to talk out and explain and flesh out what those expectations are as they rise to the surface, where she says, now you're my husband in her mind, and he says, now you're my wife in his mind. And there's these two sets of expectations crashing into each other. And perhaps that first night. And then the first baby. And then the next child. And then high school. And then they go off to college, and then it's the empty nest. And you're left with each other. Families. Families. Well, there's no functional family that I can find. There are forgiven families that we do find who are in Christ. And families are always in process. As I said in this class, we all have something. We are all broken. We all have something we attach ourselves to because of our life issues from the past. And so I wanted to give you that lead into how families get into the area of dysfunctionality as it pertains to addiction and breaking the addiction cycle. Georgina Kuntz gives us some valuable, down-to-earth information to help us understand the nature of addiction and the family in more detail. A couple videos ago, we touched on some family things as it came to tribe and also to family structure and in general, more generic. But today we're going to get more into the family structure itself, the nuclear family, and how addiction plays out as a pattern, as a system, and also as a result, or the results that come as addiction surfaces in the family structure and experience. So Georgina, she says, normal is a setting on the hairdryer. The effects of living with addiction and how to recover. Well, I'm sure you've seen something like this at a party or at a family gathering, and some of you are looking at this picture saying, that's my family, right there. There's the uncle right there with his political button on, and he's cursing to the other aunt on the other side of the table, who of course seems to be yelling at perhaps it's her husband and the uncle. You see wine on the table. You see the dad, the father of the house, saying, I can't handle it anymore with all this chaos. I need another drink. And, of course, you've got the rebellious teenager with his choice of alcohol. And you've got the mom who's in complete oblivion, still living in the June Cleaver days. And for those of you who may not know who June Cleaver is, there was a famous TV show in the 1950s here in America called Leave It to Beaver, and you had the housewife who looked perfect all the time. And it was, golly gee, oh boy, and isn't life nice? Kind of a plastic look, an inauthentic look, here with the kissing of the cook mom, who's trying to reassure the child, it's okay, we'll get through this. This is just Thanksgiving. Just wait until Christmas. Oh, Christmas will be a fun time. Here's to the family. Or is it? Well, dysfunctional families, addiction, riddled right through it, as you saw that in that cartoon. Dysfunction in a family can be caused by many things. A sick parent, a sick child, a mental illness, and as we've talked about before, that leads to addiction issues. And also family member, missing parent, death of a child. We're broken. We are broken people. But also anytime something concentrates the entire focus of the family on one member, this leads to dysfunction. If Johnny would just stop using crack, everything would be all right. Oh, well, hold on a minute. Is it just Johnny? No, it's the whole family. Why? Because Johnny is causing issues that create a ripple effect through the whole home, causing everybody else to try to save and fix Johnny himself from his problem. That's dysfunction. That's codependency on the family side, mom, the dad, the siblings, and Johnny. Well, Johnny is caught up in addiction to whatever it may be. So that focus is not only on that person, but also there's a lack of focus on everybody, on each individual, or rather that each person is shifting their focus on themselves, and then in being interdependent with other people in the family to just focusing on Johnny. That's the problem. Okay, normal is a setting on the dryer or the hair dryer or whatever setting you want to look at any other device. Family disease of addiction. Facts about the family disease of addiction. 28 million Americans, and it's probably more, as not everybody responds to the survey and so on, have at least one addicted parent. 12 to 15 of these still reside at the home. More than half of all addicts have an addicted parent, and one in three families report at least one member that has a problem with alcohol or drugs. 50% higher risk for having an addiction with one addicted parent, and 40 to 48% of children of addicts will marry an addict because, as we've cited before, oh, I married mom. Wow. Oh, I married my father. How did that happen? Well, you grew up with them. You grew up with mom and dad. Ladies, you will then tend to find someone who is similar to dad as far as characteristics and his nature. And same goes for you guys, looking for somebody that has characteristics, qualities of your mother. Truth. Also about the family disease. Most daughters of alcoholic fathers will marry an alcoholic unless treatment is provided. Breaking the cycle. Treatment does work, but it may take many times. And as you look at the nature of wives, you know, women seeking out the husband, husbands are there to protect, provide, so that women can feel safe, also that they can give life to all the home, the kids, and others. And what often happens is that you've got the woman looking for the man who will be that protector, and of course the man looking for that life giver in a wife. And the thing about the alcoholic husband, for example, is that if the dad of the wife is an alcoholic and she seeks out a husband and has a husband who is an alcoholic too, that translates into love, functionality, normal. The same example extends and it cross-applies to the abusive father who then therefore sets the model for the abusive husband. And so on. And it replicates from there. We often, in ministry and also in counseling, call it the abused wife syndrome. And the abused wife syndrome is where the wife who's in an abusive relationship with her husband says, well, that must be normal that he hits me. It must be normal that he verbally puts me down, and so on. And when it gets so bad that she needs to leave the house for a while, get out and will completely agree with the helpers, the counselors, those who intervene, and says, yes, you're right, he's got to go, I got to get out of that marriage, and so forth. After a while, and it's baffling, that wife may come to you as a helper or as a counselor or as a pastor and say, I got to go back to him. He's not doing well. I just talked to him the other day, and oh, he loves me. Don't you know? And unfortunately, more times out of not, she will go back. Hence the example and the fact, based on the research and also the experience here, that most daughters of alcoholic fathers will marry an alcoholic unless treatment is provided, or an abuser, or you name it. High percent of people in treatment are children of addicts. They'll tell you, I remember when Dad did this, Mom did that. I remember when they would hide the alcohol and hide the beer because the pastor is here. If the pastor is here, hide the beer! We don't want them to know. Children are born to alcoholics sometimes, have learning disabilities. We've looked at fetal alcohol syndrome briefly, but of course this is where the mom is drinking alcohol while she is pregnant or doing other things while she's pregnant that are harmful. But here, again, alcohol, of course, like cigarettes or both. Finally, in 90% of all repeated child abuse cases, alcohol or other drug use is, in fact, in the home. When it came to looking at the psychological effects of alcohol or drug abuse or addiction in general, it will often then impair the person and their judgment, their behavior, impulse control, and everything else. Hence, when it comes to drug and alcohol abuse, that will be found in the home with the abused kids because that will lead to the lack of judgment and therefore the overreaction, the slap, the hit, and progressing into dangerous, violent behavior. John Bradshaw says, chronically dysfunctioning families are also delusional. Delusion is sincere denial. Yeah, when confronted, yeah, the dad says, he fell off a skateboard again. Love that dang thing, that skateboard, oh! Yeah, broke his arm, or did he? And denial runs deep. Oh, that's not happening, no. No, he got in a fight with the boys down the street when it was really the dad who couldn't take it anymore and let the kid have it. Chronically dysfunctioning families are also delusional, and delusion is sincere denial, stating, I got it all together, you don't, and you don't know what you're talking about. How often have you heard that from people? Dysfunctional families. Basic family roles in dysfunctional families. Each family member is affected as the chemically dependent person. And you can even put food in there because with food comes chemicals and also other things. And other things go through the progression of the illness. Each family member reacts with a survival behavior. That is a behavior which causes the least amount of personal stress. As we say, we go through the path of least resistance. And families just want to deny that this is that the dysfunction is even going on. And they dive into work, they dive into school, or both, or into another relationship, and think that's going to take care of it. Hence, other addictions. There are five basic roles. There are five basic roles that spring up in dysfunctional families that deal with addiction. Here's a summary. The first is the chief enabler, usually the spouse of the dependent person, the one who's drinking the alcohol, shooting up the heroin, or whatever. The other four roles are usually taken on by the children of the family. If there are four children, let's say, typically one role will be seen in each child. If there are less than four, each child may take on more than one role. With more than four children, there may be two of the same roles. Here they are. Dysfunctional family roles. You have the hero, the scapegoat, the mascot, and the invisible. The hero, the scapegoat, the mascot, and the invisible. Well, let's look at the chief enabler, the chief codependent, we call them, him or her, and the person who is closest and most dependent on by the chemically dependent person. The enabler becomes totally involved in the mood swings of the dependent to keep the semblance of normalcy, that is, make sure everything feels normal. The enabler needs to become more and more responsible. Hence, the enabler becomes the one who keeps things going in the household, who pays all the bills, who calls the boss let's say it's he who is dependent on alcohol or other drugs, and she then calls the boss at his work and says, he's sick today, he can't come in, I'm sorry, he'll be in a little later, or. You get the idea. Or as well as making sure that the kids are okay, that takes care and takes responsibility for everything that the dependent person is not doing a thing about. He or she is focused only on the drug of choice. Substances, people, places, and things. Work, gambling, the list goes on. It all fits in this dysfunctional family framework, as we look at the chief enabler, the hero, the scapegoat, and so forth. Well, here we are. The family hero does the shirt thing, has the big S on the chest. The family hero can see and hear more of what is happening in the family and begins to feel responsible for the family pain. The hero works hard to make things better for the family and works diligently to improve the situation. Because the chief enabler quite often will be the wife, well, it's wife or husband, let's put it that way. Quite often it's depicted as the wife, not always true as far as being the enabler. Because often the wife could be the addict and the husband could be the one who is the one making sure everything is taken care of. As the chief enabler. But then you have Johnny, who is not the addict here, but he is the firstborn child who says, Dad shouldn't be doing this. Mom's in trouble. We need me to take care of the day. And here he goes. Wow, Mom, lie down. Dad, it's okay. I've got it. I'll save the day. Children, not to fear. I am here. And so the family hero can see and hear more of what is happening in the family and begins to feel responsible for the pain. The hero works hard to make things better for the family and works diligently to improve life. Well, then you've got the scapegoat. Yeah, the person who does not wish to work as hard as the hero to prove himself worthy. You can almost see the cause and the effect. You got the hero is trying to save the day. Have no fear, I am here. And then you've got the brother or the sister is the scapegoat saying, well, there's really nothing for me to do. And I just kind of feel in the middle, quite from the second born, who, you know, based on birth order study, the second born is kind of trying to find himself or herself anyway, and feels a bit odd because they're in between, and looks for support from peers outside of the home instead. Scapegoat. The lost child, perhaps it's that baby, the family, that or that third born, suffers loneliness, even though being alone is the situation where the child is most comfortable. Now let's say it's only three kids, and this kid could be the lost child, as well as the invisible child, which I think that's self-explanatory. But breaking it down, unpacking it, he or she will suffer loneliness, even though being alone is the situation where the child is most comfortable. Because then there's no pain. Then there's no one to invade my space, my bubble. I'm okay here. I'm the man. I'm the gal. I'm the woman here. I'm in charge. No one can hurt me here. And the growing chaos of the family pressures the lost child to look for validation within personal resources such as fantasies. And they'll go into another world in their mind. And so, books, movies, binge-watching now is now the new drug of choice coming from Netflix or Hulu or with Amazon Prime. Just keep it coming. And gets lost in the fantasy. Loneliness. I won't hurt anymore. So they think. Then there's the mascot. Cute, fun to be around, able to use charm, humor to survive in a painful family system. No one sees the fear deep within. So, the clown of the family, kind of like the clown of the class, or the class clown, the family clown, the one who will break the pressure if the stress level is through the roof and the yelling is too much. The lonely child will retreat, and the mascot will say, well, this happened today. Hey, did you hear the joke, Gwen? Breaking that pressure. Well, then, we look at dysfunctional families. They have five unhealthy rules. Oh, and by the way, getting back to the other role, too, the invisible child just feels, again, like the lonely child, just invisible, not... No one really notices them, and they're isolating anyway. They feel no one cares, and they retreat. Now, the unhealthy rules. They are usually unspoken, but are still accepted and followed by all in order to maintain the status quo in the family. You can make profound changes, Georgina says here, in your family relationships by doing the opposite of each of these rules. Here they are. The five rules are don't talk, don't trust, don't feel, don't be selfish, don't rock the boat. And of course, the opposite is do talk, do trust, do feel, do be selfish, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as you love yourself. Jesus quoting Deuteronomy in Matthew chapter 22. Don't rock the boat? You better believe it. Rock the boat. Say something. That can lead to the salvation of the addict and the enabler. So, some other things to look at. Difficulty in accurately identifying and expressing feelings is also a truth in dysfunctional families and families racked by addiction. problems in forming and maintaining close, intimate relationships. How come? It's because, well, if I am always in conflict with my spouse as the enabler with the addict, or vice versa, why would I trust anybody else? Because the one who's closest to me, I can't even trust. Therefore, I can't trust anybody else. And also, other people don't really want to be around me because I'm always talking about my issues and my problems, and they drift away. So, forget all of them. And we get into the whole mode of ultimatums, absolutes, assumptions that don't bring us to healing. And also higher than normal prevalence of marrying a person from another dysfunctional family or a person with active alcoholism or addiction. Again, the dysfunctional family syndrome or the abusive wife syndrome. The syndrome that is where, well, this must be normal, so I'm going to go marry that. And when they say, I do, the expectations rise to the surface and hit me now is the insanity. Because that says, I love you. Let's yell. Let's break trust. Let's do things that cross the line. See how far we can go with this. Because that's love, after all, isn't it? Biblically speaking, of course, no, it isn't. It's dysfunctional. Perfectionism, unrealistic expectations of self, others, and being too hard on oneself. And quite often with coming back to the roles of the family, you'll have the lonely child and also the hero, the mascot, and then the scapegoat, where the perfectionism of the addict, because that will also come out, as well as the unrealistic expectations, they often will feel like, oh, it is my fault underneath all of it, no matter what identity they take on. And they deep down do not want to be like mom and dad in this hell that they're living in. And as we cited earlier, if help or treatment is not sought out, it will repeat. It will reproduce. Finally, rigidity in behavior and attitudes, having an unwillingness to change. Why change? This is normal, so they think. Also having a resistance to adapting to change, fear of taking risks, feeling over-identified or responsible for others' feelings or behavior, which is codependency, having a constant need for approval or attention from others to feel good about themselves, which also falls under the codependent pattern. And awkwardness in making decisions, feeling terrified or making mistakes, and may defer decision-making to others. If you notice how some people may apologize for everything, and they get too much into this. A couple months ago, I did a funeral for a 12-year-old who was getting back, we think, at siblings in a tiff, in an argument, and wanting attention that was more healthy, and but then went down a negative path, saying, "Well, I'm going to fake a suicide, and then see if you'll pay attention." But the fake became real, and the 12-year-old hung herself, unfortunately. In a meeting with the mom and the dad, there were no signs of suicidal ideation. There are no signs of self-destructive behavior with this young girl. But when the dad talked about the brother, when the dad was reflecting on helping him to get through this loss, he and his wife, the mom and the dad were both commenting how this son, the sibling of the dead girl, was always apologizing, always feeling responsible, always, 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 always. very codependent, because if they, the mom and the dad and sister who is now gone, and others were not having a good day or okay, then he was not okay and felt responsible for their behavior. It's very real. And maybe you're feeling that here today too. Maybe you're saying, boy, Dr. Mark, you are just touching on everything that is going on with me. My family is just like that family in that cartoon. And you're beginning to do some self-inventory, which is good. And as you are taking this course in order to get the tools to be able to help someone else, to minister to families in overall, it begins with ourselves as leaders. And as servant leaders, we have to be always aware of what's happening in our minds, families, and lives. Some other things to look at. Feeling powerless and ineffective. Like whatever the addict does not make a difference to change things, to make things better. Exaggerated feelings of shame, worthlessness. Like the young man who I was just talking about. Low self-esteem. Avoiding conflict at any price. But did you know conflict is good? Conflict is healthy? Conflict is a fact of life? Yeah, we all know this. But most of us don't want to deal with it. Ever! That's our feeling. But the fact is that conflict is needed to grow, to become, to integrate all of our issues into healthy responses and also self-management under the power of the Holy Spirit, of course. That's a given. God is in control. God is our Lord and our Savior. But we still deal with ourselves. And with God's help, we can overcome. And of course, too, avoiding conflict at any price, again, will often repress your own feelings in these dysfunctional families, and opinions to keep peace, apprehension over abandonment by others. What if they leave me? And acting belligerently and aggressively to keep others at a distance. Tendencies to be impatient, over-controlling. A failure to take proper care of self because of their absorption in their needs and concerns of other people. Acting like martyrs. Living for others instead of for oneself. And of course, we're addressing here the members of the family who are dealing with the addict. And so there is these unhealthy patterns of behavior the family will take on and keep going if it's not dealt with. People who come from dysfunctional families are not destined for a dysfunctional life, Bo Bennett declares. I'll say it again. People who've come from dysfunctional families are not destined for a dysfunctional life. It's like I said before, you can change. You do not have to go down the path of the abused wife syndrome, ladies. You can become a woman of God who is set free and also can deal with the family of origin with God's power, in God's power and strength, and become healthier and healthy, knowing the triggers, knowing the stuff going on, and breaking the cycle. Because this truth resonates, doesn't it, gentlemen? You do not have to be the abusive father. You do not have to go down the path of alcohol. Whatever is modeled to you that was bad, that was addictive behavior, with God's help and the help of God's people, we can behave healthy. The functional family. Getting better. That's our hope. Get help. Identify. Express emotions. Allow you to feel angry about what happened. Now, some of you are wired in a way, temperamentally, where you feel like, oh, if I say I'm angry because, that's not kind. No, you need to say, I am angry because, A, to get it out of you, otherwise if it's stuffed in, it turns into depression. B, the other person who where the anger is pointed towards needs to know that that's not okay, whatever it is. And that they have crossed the line, or something crossed the line, or something went awry, and we need to deal with it. Conflict is good. Resolution is needed. So, 4, begin the work of learning to trust others. You can learn to trust. And when you experience those who have come from more trustworthy families, where they have been more aware of their dysfunction, because we all have it, and are in a healthier stead in the power of Christ, that's where that we can say, okay, let's learn together. Okay, let's get these steps in action. Let's help each other. And one to the next, you can continue to then learn how to trust other people. Also, too, practice taking good care of yourself. Love your neighbor, love the Lord your God, and then love your neighbor as you take care of you. Also, begin to change your relationships with your family. No, it's not okay, Dad. Mom, I just know. Johnny, I've about had it, and it's not going to, it will stop. I didn't know that made you angry. Can often be the response. I'm offended, says Dad. Good. That's okay. Because if he's offended, that means you hit it where it hurt. You hit it where it needed to be. To say, Dad, it needs to change with your language, your behavior. No more. But it takes courage. It takes, number one, getting help. Identify your own emotions. Working on you so you can then deal with others. The 3 C's of Al-Anon and real change. Now, Al-Anon, for those of you who don't know, is the group for the enablers. It's the group that is opposite the Alcoholics Anonymous group. So you have AA, and then you have Al-Anon, for those of you who may not be familiar. And Al-Anon then addresses the codependency issue. The 3 C's of Al-Anon, as we've come to understand codependency, and real change, are looking, I didn't cause it. That's the first C, cause. The second C is, I can't cure it, or I can't fix it. Or actually, the C here is cure. I can't cure it. And the final C, I can't control it, or her, or him. I can't control it. Here's some websites. I'll leave it here on the screen here for a moment. Of course, Al-Anon, Naranon. You have Narcotics Anonymous, and then you have Narcotics. You have Naranon for those who are dealing with the addict who is hooked on narcotics. And of course, adultchildren.org, CODA, Adult Children of Alcoholics, and other things of that nature. And CelebrateRecovery.com, which Celebrate Recovery is a Christ-based recovery program, and they have valuable Christ-centered material as well. In fact, in Celebrate Recovery, they have taken a lot of what's in AA and Al-Anon, and they've carried it over into a biblical framework. And if you have any questions, of course, that's okay. Feel free to email them, and we can then maybe, you know, get some more answers to you. But also, too, there's some things about addiction in the family that we need to understand. And we'll go over a few things from SAMHSA, which is the United States federal government level of study on addictions and also substance abuse. And what they have found through government studies, alcohol is one of the most commonly misused substances, which is no big surprise. Majority in the West are current or past users of at least one psychoactive drug. And of course, as we look at tobacco, widely used, heroin, not as much, but then of course THC leading to marijuana is used, alcohol, very strong, and cocaine is in the mid-range. Substance abuse disorders and the family, you have the individual, as the individual relates to the family, which we've been discussing. The individual exists in the context of a larger system, which is the family. And of course, as we look at family influences on substance abuse, we look at biological, the psychological, the developmental, and social. Biological, you have novel-seeking temperaments, genetic predictors of response, metabolism, risk, or later dependence, family factors, of course, and also other independent factors, psychiatric and social. The family perspectives. Families develop patterns, and we've identified that with the family roles, to use which become integrated into the family structure, which become modeled and passed on into future generations. You become like your family, unless you get help. Now we look at other cultures, and that's what they've done here, here in the U.S. They've looked at other examples, the Qat, Afghanistan, Africa, Yemen, ganja, West Indian cultures. Also, you look at religiosity and personal conservatism. And the comparison is that, look at the whole family, we look at the West and the East, and there's similarities. Of course, in the West, we look at the individual. In the East, we look at the group and how the patriarch and matriarch is in command. You have similar effects here in the West, but not so much because it's always, what are you going to do, son, daughter? How are you going to chart your course, they say. Of course, we know God charts our course. That's obvious. But here we want to, again, examine the patterns. The alcoholic family, when the appropriate and sensible use of substances merges into inappropriate and unsafe use, that leads to the domestic violence, abuse of all kinds, and impaired relationships and dysfunctional family responses. The domestic violence, very high. Approximately 80% of spouse-to-spouse violence is alcohol-related. Physical abuse of children involves 20-30% of parents who are heavy drinkers. And the child abusing parents is often under the influence of alcohol when the incident occurs. As we said in the last video, impaired motor movement, impaired impulse control. Other issues, marital conflict, as we identified, parental attachment, they've identified, family of origin issues, and cross-generational effects. Rituals, the family dance, it's called. Rituals, and perhaps these are other frameworks that will help you in your ministry and will help you to best approach families and individuals in their need. So the family dance framework says, well, rituals are symbolic, self-sustaining, self-corrective, anticipatory. Alcohol and substance use can have a highly disruptive effect on family rituals. Uncle Tom ruins each Christmas dinner by becoming intoxicated and belligerent, like the cartoon we saw earlier in this session. Family responses, sequences of behaviors that emerge as a response of members in alcoholic families. It's predictable, individuated to the family, a family pattern of response. Not only do we look at Christmas, all holidays, or it's the tradition and family dance and ritual that every Saturday night we go to the restaurant and Dad is always at the bar. That's just what we do. And of course, families then eventually realize that that's not healthy and things are falling apart, and they come to you as pastor or as Christian leader and say, help. And they don't see the obvious where the ritual and the dance is where Dad is at the bar at the restaurant on Saturday night, or at Christmas and or other holiday dinners that everyone's getting intoxicated, which is supposed to be okay because we're celebrating. Oh, really? So, predictable, individuated. And then we look at response patterns. The role changes, like we talked about. Family energy surrounded by the substance use and its sequelae, as they put it here. But also, you know, the focus is taken off the healthy interdependence and focus only on the one who's abusing the alcohol or whatever else. Family defenses of ambivalence and denial. Social withdrawal and isolation. Fear. Shame. Kids. Conduct and academic problems. Emotional difficulties, which we touched on again with the lonely child, or of course the hero and the other ones. Potential causal effects on earlier onset on drinking. Biological. The modeling. What is Dad modeling every time you go to the restaurant and he's at the bar? Oh, yeah, not only is he drinking, but he's also separating himself, isolating himself. Maybe that's what his dad did. Maybe that's something he just started to do. We have to look at what was modeled to Dad or the addict. Adaptation to family dysfunction. This is normal, and so on. Biological, psychological, and social influences. So social influences, crime, financial, health effects, foster care, social interactions, isolation, and shame. Like I said before, I need the drug, I steal the money, I get put in jail. Financial, or the domestic violence situation where someone's hit, caught, arrested, and they serve prison time. Financial, of course, all the money goes to who? The addict. And the addict steals all the money. And therefore, you can't pay the rent, you can't buy food, you can't live. Health effects, heart attack, stroke, and so on. Why? Because the addict is overdoing it. Or the stress level that causes others in the family to turn to addiction, addictive behaviors, overeating, gambling, other things to medicate the pain and shame, or just that they are codependent and they're addicted to people, places, and things, trying to make everything okay, trying to fix everybody, which doesn't work. Health effects, foster care, because as we identified too, the Child Protective Services, or whatever it's called in your locale, will then come in and then take the kids away because the kids are being abused. Social interactions, isolation. So family considerations in the treatment of substance abuse disorders, the best treatment programs are comprehensive, multidimensional, because we look at family services, vocational services, medical services. As you see in the middle of the screen here, intake screening. In other words, where if the addict comes to hit a bottom, which is our hope, and also the family together hitting the bottom, where all they can do is look up and look to God for help. For Christ then is the way, the truth, and the life. Interesting how Scripture comes right in there, and we say, no, these are not the ways. It's like with Israel in the theology of addiction session. We talked about how Israel looked to the idols, the Baals, and getting attached to them and doing sexual acts right in the middle of the field in the broad daylight to please the gods, to have a good harvest. When God said, no, I am your Lord and God. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and life. I created you to be mine, to have a relationship with God. So the addict then comes into the screening session to just, you know, again, a profile is taken, a record is taken, to get a good picture of what's happening. And, of course, substance use monitoring, legal services here, medication, therapy, support groups, educational services, where classes are then offered. All of the above together is where this needs to go, because one cannot do it alone, ever. 1 Corinthians 15, it says at the end of the chapter, your labor in the Lord is not in vain. You are never alone. Well, if the biblical foundation and, of course, God's creation is in community, then help for the family needs to be in community. Not always with individuation. It's also, it takes a team. Always. So treatment can be effective. Drug treatment reduces drug use, of course, a lot. 40 to 60%. Treatment does not have to be voluntary to be effective. When I was a case manager in Chicago, and my clients would stop taking their medications because they started to feel better, so they thought, and talked themselves into the and rationalized and thought, well, here's my pill box. No, I don't have to take that one anymore. No, I'm feeling better. Boy, I just don't like, because they don't like to taking their medications. And then after a few days, a couple of weeks, then what we began to see at that time, and still happens today, of course, they begin to act out, and they begin to behave in the disorders that they've got. And then what happens is we have to get them to the hospital. Same thing with addiction, and of course with my clients at that time, they also dealt with addiction, getting into the hospital and addressing all the above, involuntary, get a judge's order, committed to the treatment, and forced on them. It's not always bad. And after the fact, often they'll say, thank you for doing what you needed to do. Family influences can help facilitate entry and engagement in the treatment process. Again, it takes a team. It takes the family. Lack of family support has been implemented in poor compliance with treatment recommendations as well. It gets to be complicated. Well, you had the screening. There's the professional with the person who needs the help. Then you have therapeutic interventions for family members, stress management, assertiveness training, psychoeducation, addressing family communication and response patterns, problem-solving tasks. These are therapies in treatment. There's what exactly happens with the person and the family as they get help. The family considerations in substance use disorders include biological, developmental, and social contributions, and it is difficult to establish cause and effect, easier to note correlations. Addiction continues to be baffling. And relapse, then back into treatment, can be a revolving door. Finally, though, the family should be an integral part of a multidisciplinary treatment approach. As we conclude our study on the family, addiction, getting help, but also understanding why things happen, how things happen. And yet there's, again, some mystery, and yet no mystery. However, we go back to the main issue, and that is, and what you'll find with many professionals that do not go there, is the spiritual problem of sin. Sin. We are separated from God, and we don't know God's will, but through Christ we come to know God's will, and we get the help that we need so we can break free from these attachments, these idols called addictions, and begin to live a godly, Christ-centered life, where Jesus then becomes the one to bring the family back into reconciliation. And so with the family, you also see a biblical framework happening, a biblical need that is there. Because that's where it had to be in the first place. Families need to be centered on the one who made them, Jesus Christ. God bless you, and we'll see you next time.